everybody. I'm back after a little bit of a break. I went to California for the NAMM show and to catch a bunch of comedy and all that fun stuff. Since I've been back, I've been catching up on work and parenting and all that. My poor kitty passed away a few days ago, so you'll no longer be hearing him scratching away in the background during interviews. The dog's okay, the dog's dealing with it fine. But yeah, so I had a really good time in California. NAMM's always great because I get to catch up with my NAMM squad or my NAMM buddies. And you know, every year your NAMM squad grows and you find more people to hang with, you catch up with old friends, and it was really great. I finally got to see Extreme, which is, you know, they're one of my favorite bands of all time, and I've never been able to see them before. Last time they played in Australia, I think I was like 12 years old or something, so, and that was an amazing show, one of the best concerts I've ever seen. They just killed it. What else did I do? I saw an Eric Johnson concert, and I got to have breakfast with him and a few other media folks and Fender folks, and check out his new Thin Line Telecaster, Stratocaster, which is just incredible. I was working at the Seymour Duncan booth, and we had Seymour there winding pickups like every day. Yeah, including the Sunday. Yeah, he was a machine. He was just, you know, telling stories and making pickups and taking photos and stuff the whole time. It was really cool. What else did I do? Man, it all just kind of blends in together. I caught up with Earl Skakel, the comedian who you would have heard a few episodes back, and yeah, we got to hang out at the Comedy Store. I went to Cantor's Deli a lot to just eat way too much. So that was really fun. I went to the Twin Peaks pop-up bar, which was really great. If you're a Twin Peaks fan, then too bad, it's already closed down, but that was really cool. I went to Scum and Villainy Cantina, which is inspired by the Star Wars Mos Eisley Cantina, so, you know, for a nerd like me, that was really cool. And just had a great old time. If you want to support the podcast, don't forget you can hit up Patreon/iHeartGuitar. Or PayPal.me/iHeartGuitar and chuck me a few bucks. You don't have to, but if you want to, it all helps. Yeah, this week's episode, let's get into that. My guest is Mark Gemini Thwaite. Now, he's had a really enviable career and still has. Like, he's played with The Mission, Gary Numan, Al Jorgensen, Tricky, Peter Murphy, Ascension of the Watchers, as well as doing his own music. Now, his solo project has morphed into under the name MGT in partnership with vocalist Ashton Knight of The Awakening. The new album is called Gemini Knight, and it's out on February 23, and it's loaded with great songs. It's kind of like classic, like goth rock kind of stuff, but with a bit of a modern edge as well. It's got Paul Ferguson of Killing Joke on drums, and there are guest appearances by Burton C. Bell from Fear Factory, and original Cure members Lol Tolhurst and Pearl Thompson. It's really great, and I definitely recommend you check it out. Mark also has a really beautiful Schecter Solo 2 signature model guitar. It's like this kind of great purpley blue color, and it's got gold hardware and a Bigsby, and I love it. So we talk about that in the interview too. And so here it is. I hope you dig it.
Hello there, everyone. This is Mark Gemini Thwaite. Yes, that is my real name. Guitar player for MGT, which is also my initials, formerly of British goth rockers The Mission, Peter Murphy, Tricky, and countless other bands as well.
And you have a brilliant new record that I've just been listening to. And, dude, I am so jealous of you because this is like the album I want to make right now.
I beat you to it.
Yeah, you bastard.
Well, as you know, I did a solo album last year, which was I put out under my initials, my acronym MGT, because a lot of the Mission fans used to just refer to me as MGT because it's less of a mouthful. And so when I did this solo album with all these guest vocalists, Vile Valo said, oh, you know, rather than calling it Mark Gemini Thwaite, which is a bit of a mouthful for our German DJs, why don't you just call it MGT, like the fans call you. So that's how MGT was born as an artist. And then this new album is a follow-up. Yeah, the last album was me with all my mates on vocals because I've got a rubbish voice. And I just came up with the bright idea, okay, I'll be Jimmy Page, I'll write all the music, Led Zeppelin style, and I'll get, you know, some great singers and ask my friends to sing on it, including Vile Valo and Wayne Hussey from The Mission and loads of singers, a lot of British-based guys like Miles Hunt from The Wonder Stuff and Julian Reagan from All About Eve, Saffron from Republica, and so on, and Ashton Knight, who was a South African singer that I was introduced to. And the album went down really well, and I did a couple of tracks with Ashton, the South African singer, and both those tracks were definitely, you know, leaning towards my goth rock background. Hard hitting, you know, with definite gothic rock overtones. And we just kept writing, and before we knew it, we had a whole album written. So this is the fruition of that collaboration and this new album. Still going under the moniker MGT, because that's what the label wanted, but it's actually myself and Ashton. So MGT is now the name of the band, and the new album's coming out in February.
And of course, it's called Gemini Night, which brings your names together and kind of, helps to explain it, I think.
Yeah, the actual original, our original plan was we were going to call the band the Gemini Night, which was a play. I actually came up with it as a joke. You know, I was like, oh, why don't we take my middle name and your last name and call it Gemini Night? You know, like in a real smashy, nicey kind of DJ way. And we thought it was hilarious. And then people were going, yeah, that's pretty cool, you know. So it kind of stuck. So a lot of our demos, we were labeled as Gemini Night. But then when we signed a new deal with Cleopatra, they were like, we absolutely love the album, everything about it. But, you know, they just assumed it would be coming out as MGT. And we were like, oh, no, we actually thought it was going to be Gemini Night, you know, brand new name. And they were like, oh, no, you guys are crazy. You know, you've done all this work last year, you know, with the MGT Volumes album and the great success of the track with Vile Valo, over 2 million views on YouTube and 250,000 plays on Spotify. You'd be crazy to start off with a new name. You should capitalize on the work you did last year. So we both sort of agreed to that. So I said, let's just call the album Gemini Night then. So all those references we've made to Gemini Night in the past on social media aren't completely wasted, because it'll still point to this new album. Yeah. So that was the thinking.
Cool. Yeah, there's a great variety of stuff here, but it is very much anchored in that kind of, you know, goth rock sound.
Unashamedly, you know, we did the two tracks I did with Ashton were arguably the most goth rock sounding tracks on Volumes. And I was like, hey, man, let's just make a whole album that's unashamedly in that genre, you know. Although I kind of see it more as like modern goth rock. You know, it's got more in common with somebody like Marilyn Manson or Rob Zombie, you know, or Rammstein, you know, and none of those are considered to be gothic rock bands. But I think sonically we're kind of touching upon the kind of area that those bands are in, as opposed to real proper gothic bands like Joy Division and so on.
Well, definitely a song like Dystopia, there's some, you know, crushing heavy guitars there that, you know, don't sound like 80s goth rock or anything.
No, you know. There's echoes of, my old band The Mission and, you know, stuff that I was influenced by, like The Cult and Killing Joke and all those great bands, The Cure, of course, and by coincidence, we end up working with a couple of The Cure guys on the record. But we wanted it to sound more modern and hard-hitting, you know, as well. Ashton's voice is in that classic sort of deep register, Peter Murphy, Andrew Eldritch kind of overtones. So I think anything he sings on just automatically sounds in that genre, to be honest. You know, kind of nudges it that way.
Losing my voice here. I'm just going to have to mute, cough, and then come back.
There you go.
All right. So tell us more about working with Pearl Thompson and Lol Tolhurst, because, I mean, I'm a huge Cure nerd, and that to me is like really exciting.
Yeah, it was a fantastic, thing that happened this year. It all started with I didn't know either of them. I was introduced to Pearl Thompson, the ex-Cure guitarist who formed the band with Lol Tolhurst and Robert Smith back in the late 70s. I ran into Pearl at the NAMM convention in Los Angeles in January of this year because I was there to promote my new Schecter signature guitar. Give that a little plug there. And I had to do a signing and stuff. And Pearl was there because he was a Schecter artist as well. And of course, we got chatting, and he was really loving my new signature model, and we exchanged information, and before we knew it, we were talking about collaborating, and I said, well, funnily enough, I'm just doing a new album with Ashton. It might be cool to get you to play some guitar on it, and so I sent him a demo. This was like back in the spring. And he was in the middle of preparing to move from somewhere in the desert, like Mojave Desert way, I think. He was going to move nearer to the outskirts of Los Angeles during the summer. So he said it might take him a while, but, you know, he'll work on it. And, of course, I didn't push him. And then he had an art exhibition in West LA in the summer, and that's where I met Lowell, who came along to the art exhibition. Lowell, another founder member, originally the drummer from The Cure, and then he ended up... I was going to say promoted to keyboards, but that's being a disservice to drummers. But he ended up moving from drums to keyboards through The Cure's career. So I always wonder what I should refer to him. But I think most people think of him now as a keyboard player with The Cure. And got a chat with him. It turns out we live about a mile apart, or maybe even less than a mile. It's crazy. So we were like, well, we must hang out. So I started hanging out with Lowell. And we got a lot of mutual friends, and I say, well, Pearl's working on this track. Maybe I should get you to add some keyboards to it. You know, it'd be like a no-brainer, right? And, of course, this is fantastic for me and Ashton because we're both huge fans of The Cure. So Pearl ended up, putting down some guitars, and I kept reminding him of the album mastering deadline, and he ended up missing it largely because he was moving and just distracted with other stuff. So we didn't actually make the album pressing with the track that they played on. So that song, The Assembly Line, is on the physical version of the album. But I ended up getting Pearl's guitars and getting Lowell's keyboard parts and doing a brand new mix. So it's like an alternative version of that song. And it's going to just get a standalone release, I think, in February, The Assembly Line Cured Mix, which is the name of Lowell's recent autobiography, The Cured. And that's going to get a standalone release, and then I imagine it will also be like tacked on as a digital bonus, I would have thought, to the album, you know. And let's face it, most folks nowadays just buy albums digitally, or they listen to it on Spotify streaming. So it'll be on the album, but it actually technically missed the physical pressing of the CD, but that'll kind of make it more exclusive in a way.
Yeah, cool. I'm about halfway through Lowell's book at the moment, and I got the audiobook version, so it's really cool to hear stories, you know, in his voice and his words.
Yeah, that's great. I didn't listen. I actually read the paperback that he gave me. Actually, no, he gave me a hardback, and I read it, like, over a weekend, and it was fantastic, and then he mentioned there was actually an audiobook version that he actually insisted on doing himself, which I'm sure was fantastic. I might have to just get it just so I can listen to it.
Yeah. I'm sitting here surrounded by a bunch of rock biographies and stuff. Are you much of a reader of the old rock tome?
I am, yeah. I mean, right before I read Lowell's Cured biography, I read the Steve Jones biography, Lonely Boy. Prior to that, I read Keith Richards' Life biography. I read a Marlon Brando biography before that, and I've got a couple of biographies that are coming up. I've got an Adam Ant one to read, and Al Jurgensen's one, which I was given. I'm going to read that as well. That'll be interesting because, you know, I did work with him briefly a few years ago. Not that he probably remembers. He was probably in a haze of drugs and alcohol, but that's pretty much all I do read, actually, is biographies of musicians or, you know, famous people that I'm interested in, you know. I always find them fascinating.
Yeah. You know what's a good one is David Lee Roth's book, because it's batshit crazy and it's probably not true, and he, like, it's just weird and Dave stories, but it turns out that, like, Henry Rollins wrote some of it, and, you know, Dave was like, write a story about, you know, me doing this. And he's like, okay, cool. And, you know, it's just all
That's
over
brilliant.
The place.
Yeah. I mean, also, Lowell told me that there's talk of his biography being made into a movie or something. So, they'll base, like, obviously, it's going to be about The Cure, and obviously, I imagine a big focus on Robert Smith, but it's actually going to be based on largely on Lowell's biography because, you know, he's the first guy to really, you know, put it down in print properly from the horse's mouth. Nobody knows more than Lowell. He was there, right? He was like school friends with Robert, you know, before they were ever in a band together, you know, so they really go right back.
Yeah. Not to geek out too much on The Cure and stuff, but I saw them last year, and then Reeves invited me back to, like, hang out with the lads at the hotel bar and stuff. And they were all there except for Robert, who I'm sure was resting his voice after singing like a god for 3 hours. And what really struck me is, you know, sometimes you hang out with bands and they talk shit about the guy who's not there or whatever. But they all seem to have real respect for, you know, his talent and stuff. And, you know, at this point in their careers, they don't need to be kissing the ass of the guy who's not there. But, you know, they definitely seem to, you know, still... I mean, that guy's a genius, and everyone knows it.
He's such a massive body. I think I've lost track of how many albums they've done, but they just are pretty consistent, you know, and just got such a massive volume of work that's just amazing, you know. I got a lot of respect for The Cure and for Robert Smith as an artist, you know. Very cool.
Yeah. Now, you also just put out an album with Chuck from Faith No More, who just passed away, which is horrible news. But can you tell us about that record?
Yeah, always been a huge Faith No More fan. Earlier Faith No More, I first got into them when Chuck was the singer back in the 80s. And We Care A Lot was actually a minor hit in the UK, I think before anywhere else. Like, they were a bigger deal in the UK, and they were largely ignored in the States, their home country. So, in a way, you know, as Brits gave them like a little kickstart to their career, and quite rightly so, because We Care A Lot was a fantastic track, and it had like great crossover elements of metal and hip hop, and like echoes of Killing Joke to me, one of my favorite bands, in the sound of that song with the keyboards and stuff like that, and the drum attack. I'd always been a fan of Chuck's, and then he left or parted ways with Faith No More, and they got in Mike Patton, and I was a big fan of that era as well, you know. Angel Dust and those albums were fantastic. So fast forward many, many years later, I do a record back in 2014 with Primitive Race, which was a collective of musicians, myself being one of them, put together by this guy, Chris Knicker, a friend of ours, and who was a record company guy who also dabbled in a bit of bass, and he just basically called upon a lot of his friends, a bit like I did with Volumes in a way, and it was partly the influence of that made me do Volumes, in that he got loads of different singers involved, and we put out an album as Primitive Race that came out in 2015, kind of a industrial slant to the whole thing. You know, he called upon a lot of his mates in the industrial field. I'm not really known to be industrial, but I was involved anyway because I'd worked with Gary Newman, and I guess my credentials were good enough. And that album did pretty good. And then he said the next album, he'd been talking to Chuck Mosley, who I'd never met, about doing a record with Chuck, but this would be a much more stripped down, you know, no synths really, just more focus on like rock and roll and you know, Chuck's vocal, and rather than it being loads of different singers, which the previous Primitive Race had been a collaboration and compilation, this would be Chuck on vocals all the way through, myself on guitar all the way through. We ended up with Dale Crover from the Melvins on drums all the way through. Chris Kanicka was on bass all the way through, Erie Locke on keyboards. And yeah, so that latest Primitive Race album was born. And I pretty much couldn't hide my admiration for Jim Martin and the old Faith No More sound. So it definitely, you know, some of that came out in the way I approached the guitars on this new album, which is called Soul Pretender. Literally a week after it came out, Chuck passed away of a drugs overdose. He'd had a long, well-publicized battle with drugs, and it was part of the reason why he'd been ejected from the original Faith No More lineup was his... you know, his ability to kind of keep his drug habit under control. And it looks like it ultimately got the better of him. But all I can say is that he did a fantastic job on this new record. We're all very proud of it. I feel honored to have been able to actually work with him and collaborate on some songs together. And I do think that, you know, it's a fitting addition to his legacy. You know, he's kind of put out a great record, and a lot of the Faith No More fans seem to really dig it, and they appreciate what we've done with that record and helped put Chuck back on the map. That was the idea. Yeah, we were talking about booking shows, we were going to do material. I really wouldn't have been surprised if we'd been asked to do the odd old school Faith No More song if we'd gone out live with him. So that would have been very interesting, and sadly now we'll never know how that would have went.
It's interesting what you say about the UK and Faith No More and stuff, because I know that here in Australia too, like, those guys are huge, like, you know, festival headlining. I know they headlined Download, I think it was, when they got back together a few years ago, and they headlined the Soundwave Festival here, and there's something about them that I think maybe American audiences don't quite appreciate the eclecticism as much as Brits and Aussies do.
Yeah. They just were like unashamedly merging all their like alternative rock and, you know, hip hop and classic rock influences, and they were just brilliant. And I think perhaps, you know, the Europeans and the Australians were perhaps a bit more open minded to it. You know, but yeah, I think the Americans appreciate them now. You know, but. It's like Hendrix. Hendrix got his first break in the UK as well. You know, that's where he broke big first, for example, you know. And then, of course, the Americans started checking him out because he was big in the UK. Same. Conversely, Def Leppard got huge in America first and not in the UK, which was kind of ironic, you know. So sometimes it goes a different way.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of bands who are, like, huge in Australia, and they just don't break overseas. And I don't know why, because some of them are, you know, truly great, and it just doesn't click over in other countries.
Yeah. I hear Midnight Oil are back doing some gigs. Is that right?
Yes, they are.
Which is they're a great band. I'm quite happy to see them back on the map.
Yeah. No, they just played a bunch of shows a few weeks ago, and I'm sure there'll be more after that. But cool band. Very there's a kind of angularity to their sound that I think is a bit post-punk, but then there's like an earthiness too.
Yeah. I've always been a big fan of Midnight Oil, and you know, I was AC/DC were one of my earliest influences, as would be the case probably with about 99% of rock guitar players. They can't deny the influence of Malcolm and Angus Young, you know, God rest his soul, Malcolm. And also huge fan of Nick Cave as well, you know, and I love his Grinderman project. Been listening to Grinderman a lot. Really good stuff.
There used to be a concert venue in Melbourne called the Crystal Ballroom in like the late 70s, early 80s, and I feel like there needs to be a documentary about that, because that's where like Nick Cave used to play, and you know, The Cure played there to like 200 people. You know, I think there's a cool story to be told there. I think there's a book about it. Needs to be a movie.
Definitely.
So one thing that keeps kind of popping into my mind as we're talking here is, my God, you've worked with some, you know, some great bands, you've been involved in some great stuff. Do you ever just kind of stop and kick yourself and go, wow, I've done a lot?
I think I'm very driven, and I always want something coming up, you know, so I guess I like to keep myself busy, pretty driven, and you know, yeah, I can stop and like look back and think, oh wow, I did this and I did that, and wow, I've achieved so much and played with so many people. But to be honest, I'm more of a looking forward person, like, what have I got coming up? What's going on in 2018? You know, what cool tools have I got coming up? Who am I working with? You know, so I'll always be like thinking, oh no, I need to be doing more, you know, I don't want to get too stagnant, you know. I guess I ultimately identify myself and how I'm doing career-wise with how busy I am, you know. I won't just stop and go, well, hey, I've ticked all those boxes and I've worked with all those bands, and so I can start to relax now. I think my motivation appears to be constant, and it's like, well, what can I do now? Who can I work with next? And, you know, let me see if I can top that album I put out last year and do an even better album this year. And you know, I guess that's just something that motivates me, and I think with a lot of people who end up, you know, making their mark, it's a common thread that they just, you know, they keep striving and keep trying to do more and more, you know?
Mm, yeah.
It's a blessing and a curse, you know. It's a curse for me because I can't just relax and go, hey, yeah, I did all this stuff. I guess I can relax now. You know, I've proved my point. I don't think like that. I feel like, no. If I'm not doing anything anymore, then that means I'm on the scrap heap. I've got to keep doing stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have a very sexy Schecter guitar.
yeah.
Tell us that about that thing.
That was the number one. That was number one. It had to be sexy, definitely. I'm into the bling on guitars. I've always been a fan of, if I was going to go for a Gibson model, I was going to go for the custom. You know, I want the block inlays, I want the triple binding, I want the whole shebang, you know. I'm not a huge fan of basic-looking guitars. So when it came to Schecter asking me about doing a signature model, I was like, yep, well, you know, I want it to be based on, you know, like on a custom, they'd put out the, which was arguably the nearest shape yet that they'd done to a Les Paul, which a Les Paul was like my most identified associated guitar for the last 20, 30 years. So I was like, yeah, I want to base it on the Solo 2. I want it to be all the custom specs with double binding. And like the color scheme, you know, I wanted it to be a blue guitar with gold hardware. I wanted it to have a B7 Bigsby. I wanted it to be a different color on the back, like the gold tops where, you know, the top is gold and then the back is like a natural wood color. I wanted that kind of flavor to it. So that's kind of where it started, and I want a mirrored scratch guard because I always used to put mirrored scratch guards on my Les Pauls previously. That was my little homage to Phil Lynott, who would always use a mirrored scratch guard on his basses, his precisions. So I'd always do a little, you know. So there's all these things that I wanted to fulfill in my own model. And but it's actually it's like a culmination of all the stuff that I would be attracted to on previous guitars that I'd played and tweaks that I would do to them. I often throw Bigsby's on my Les Pauls. I've been doing that for years. And so, yeah, the model came out and everybody's like, whoa, that's like super blingy, you know, because the top we ended up going for ultraviolet, which is blue in some lights and purple in other lights. And I was like, well, that's fantastic. And it's got this stained red back and all the gold hardware and, you know, the mirrored pick guard and blah, blah. So it looks so blingy. For me, it's like totally natural and it's just a manifestation of what I like in the guitar and how it looks, you know. Some people love it, some people hate it. You know, they're like, no, you can't put a Bigsby on a Les Paul Schecter guitar. It's, you know, and people don't like that. Everybody's got their own personal taste, you know. But one thing I can tell you, it's got my Seymour Duncans in it, which was my choice. I've got the Jeff Beck in the bridge and the Al Nico Pro 2 in the neck. Coil tapping, of course. And they're the engine of the guitar, and it just sounds fantastic, you know. And I've had a lot of compliments on the tone of that guitar. I picked a rosewood neck because it's a bit warmer than the usual predictable ivory neck that some people go for. Ebony neck. And it's just a great sounding guitar, and it's, you know, I love it. It's I definitely consider it to be a Les Paul killer. You know, it's one of the first guitars where I really don't feel the need to bring along a Les Paul in the studio or on the tour, because this MGT model totally kills it.
Yeah, well, I'm always drawn to anything with a Bigsby, because I remember being a kid watching music videos and I'd see like all these Gretches and Guilds and Gibsons and stuff with like all this stuff on them, you know, and it looked so significant.
Yeah.
You know, you see like a Rickenbacker with, you know, those, you know, the toaster pickups and all this metal and knobs, or you see like a ES-335 with a big old Bigsby, and it's like, that guitar looks like it can do some stuff, man.
Yeah, I just like details on guitars, and I found that you can throw a Bigsby on, you know, a Les Paul or any guitar, and it instantly looks like some retro, like, oh, wow, man, that must be like a 50s model or something. You know, people just associate Bigsby's with real old school, you know. It makes me think of Jimmy Page, you know, and his Black Beauty, or it makes me think of Neil Young with Old Black, or Joe Perry. you associate the Bigsby on a Les Paul with just, you know, cool fucking guitar gods like Page and Neil Young, who I think is just an amazing sounding player, you know, very unique. Love his playing on electric especially. So, yeah, I just wanted to, you know, I want my guitar to evoke that. You don't even have to use the Bigsby. I think some people, they go, wow, you can't put a Bigsby on a Les Paul or a Solibri. You know, you need to put on a Floyd Rose. They're missing the point. Yeah, that's not what you go for a Bigsby for. You're going for the aesthetic of what it looks like. And then it's just some mild trem, you know. You're not dive bombing, you know, when you got a Bigsby on a guitar like that. You know, I've never been a Floyd Rose person at all. You know, I'm just all about some mild. You know, I've got more in common with Dave Gilmour, you know. I like what he does. The subtle flourishes, subtle, you know, slow bends and stuff, you know. No dive bombing, you know, no histrionics.
I've got a Bigsby on my Ibanez Talman. It's like a sparkly silver guitar with a Bigsby and a perloid pickguard, and it's so cool. But I discovered
they're great.
Yeah, I discovered a little trick a while ago because I noticed that, you know, David Gilmour cuts his whammy bars shorter. And I was thinking, well, what's the benefit of that? And so just messing around, I tried wiggling the bar from further back just to see, to kind of approximate what might happen. And it's like, oh, yeah, naturally, you put the physics in. You plug in the physics and you're like, oh, yeah, you can't actually move it as far. And it's almost Bigsby-like.
That's right.
And, yeah, and so that's my little David Gilmour trick, is to just scooch halfway up the bar and get that same shimmer.
Yeah. And it's also probably just where he's comfortable to have his hand, you know. I always find, you know, with whammy bars, tremolo bars, it's like I'm playing, and then I move my hand, and, you know, I'm not somebody that rests my hand all the time on the whammy bar. I guess that's because it's not my style, but he's probably just picked a spot where, you know, he's more comfortable with leaving his hand near it, you know. He isn't going to go as far, you know.
Yeah.
So that makes complete sense.
So who were your big guys when you started playing?
Well, when I first got a guitar when I was 15, 79, no, 90, yeah, it was like late 79, maybe I was 14, yeah, 14, I think. And I got it because my mate Paul Bryan at school had gotten a guitar, you know, like a K guitar through a catalogue. And I was like, oh, I want to get a guitar as well. So I got one a couple of months after him, and then I was constantly playing catch up where I was trying to get up to his level. You know, he had like two or three months head start on me, and that was my carrot. So that was good. What we were listening to back then, I was listening to an awful lot of, if I remember rightly, a lot of punk rock was, punk rock was like on the radio in the UK all the time. So I was really into bands like Generation X and the Skids and the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the usual bands like that, Buzzcocks, etc. But I was also influenced by the new wave of British heavy metal, which kicked in around 1980. And you had all those bands like Iron Maiden and Def Leppard and Tigers of Pantang and all that stuff. I was like listening to that stuff as well. That kind of permeated my psyche, being from the Midlands, in Birmingham, which is pretty much the home of heavy metal. It would be sacrilege not to be listening to a bit of metal. I love Motorhead as well. And another band that perhaps revealed, my muso side was, I was listening to a lot of Rush. I went to see Rush on the, I first got into them on the Permanent Waves album in 1980, or maybe it was 79. And then I went to see them on the Moving Pictures tour, and I think that was 1980 or 81. And I was just a huge fan of Alex Lifeson, so I was like really into adding chorus and like delays to my signal. And if you listen to any of the demos that I was doing back then, early 80s, it's like you can just hear Alex Lifeson all over it. You know, it's crazy how much I was into that. And then I kind of progressed and stopped listening to Rush less. And I was also really into Gilmour as well. I wasn't really listening to bands like Zeppelin or any classic rock stuff until I got a little bit older. It wasn't until I joined the Mission around 92 and there was a huge Zeppelin influence on the Mission that I actually kind of went and checked out Zeppelin more, and then just realized how fantastic Jimmy Page was as a guitarist, you know. Really got into their back catalogue. And didn't listen to Rush and bands like that for many years. I got into like Killing Joke, and I was digging players like Steve Stevens and Geordie from Killing Joke, of course, and Paul Thompson from The Cure, and all those great guys, Stuart Anderson from The Skids. They're all huge influences on me. And then I started listening to Rush like more recently again, say maybe in the last 5 years. You know, they had a bit of a renaissance and released a few videos that I checked out, and I just was reminded, holy shit, how influenced I was by Alex Lifeson's playing. It's like crazy. I could still hear it in my sound, you know, even though perhaps nobody else can, but I can hear it, you know.
Yeah, funny. Yeah, it's weird. The first Rush album I ever heard was Roll the Bones from like 1991 or something like that, which is kind of when they started to reintroduce a bit more, a bit less keyboards and a bit more guitar again. But it still sounds...
That was part of the thing, is that I got turned off Rush. I think it took a while for me to figure that out, but it's like, I just stopped listening to them as they descended more and more into, you know, keyboard-based like songs, you know, keyboard-based albums, you know. So I just kind of stopped listening to them and moved on to different things. But more recently, I've gone back and checked out albums like Vapor Trails and Clockwork Angels, I think it is, where, you know, Alex like reclaimed the guitar position and came back with a vengeance. And I'm like, wow, these albums sound fucking great. You know, I wish I'd actually bothered to check them out. I just kind of dismissed Rush as just going up their own arse, yeah, getting really synthy, and I wanted to hear the guitars again. You know, I'm old school like that.
Yeah. There's a song on Roll the Bones. I'm just Googling the track list here so I don't get the name wrong. I believe it was Dreamline, the first track, where there's this guitar solo in it where, like, at that point in my life, I'd never been on a plane, but I heard this solo and I was like, this sounds like flying. I don't know what it is. Something about it evokes flying. And then I learned later that Alex Lifeson is a pilot. It's like, oh, man, he really captured
it. Oh, there you go. Yeah. I always thought that, you know, Alex and Geddy, you know, they're all like super serious. They always came over as super fucking serious, like in photographs and stuff like that on stage. And then it was only recently, watching, you know, documentaries on them touring, and I watched the Time Stand Still video very recently, and they're constantly goofing around. Alex Lifeson's so funny. I'm like, wow, I wish I knew how much of a sense of humor he has. You know, they're all just really goofing around all the time. I guess Neil Peart's the only one that's a little bit like more serious, you know, which makes sense because he had a lot of tragedy in his life anyway. But Alex is like such a good boy. I'd love to hang out with him. He seems like such a laugh. You know?
Yeah. Well, the documentary they released officially was great, but I think one of the funniest things is the little videos they would have at the start of their concerts, especially, you know, in the last kind of few years and stuff. There were just all these little wacky comedy skits, basically.
Yeah. They got a great sense of humor, which is fantastic. It makes me feel bad for like dismissing them in the late 80s as they got all synthy. You know, I should have given them a shot, you know. But, you know, I'm back on board now. I'm digging everything they're doing now. So it's a shame that Neil's retiring. I understand why he's retiring, you know, but it's a shame because, you know, those guys are never going to go on the road without him. Not as Rush, anyway. They've had a great run, you know. They're a fantastic band, and I'm sure that Alex and Geddy will do more. Although they haven't ruled out recording more, it's quite possible they may do another album. It just maybe they won't tour it anymore.
I'll tell you what, you mentioned kind of coming back to them. One of the greatest things to me about Spotify is being able to like dig into stuff. Like last week, I was like, you know what, I've heard a few Killing Joke songs that I always liked, but I never really dug into the albums. And so I've been doing that and, you know, some Peter Murphy stuff. And, I mean, you know, I had some Cure albums growing up, but I didn't have all of them because, you know, at that time you had to actually have the money to get the album or a friend you could take from.
Right.
And so I've been like, you know, I got my Spotify premium account and I'm like catching up on all this stuff I missed. And my God, it's like, I've never been out of love with music, but right now I'm falling in love with it even more than, you know, than I should at this point.
Yeah, Spotify is amazing. I mean, I didn't have that growing up either, obviously. And, you know, I'd have to go out and buy records or, you know, borrow records off mates or tape albums back when people would tape stuff. And today, you know what? People always talk about his album. Let me fire that up and have a listen to it and see what all the fuss is about. Yeah, you can just be as random as that. You can pick anything you like, and it's probably going to be on Spotify, and you can listen to it. And so from a consumer point of view, from a music lover point of view, it's absolutely fantastic. It's a shame from the artist's point of view that the royalty rate is so low. And I'm not going to get on my soapbox about that. You know, we all know what the story is. But hopefully they're working on it to make it a bit fairer for artists. But I have to admit, it's fantastic from, as myself, as a lover of music, it's fantastic that I can go, hey, I want to listen to that Cure album that I never actually owned. You know, I'm going to go and grab, you know, Blood Flowers because I never actually got it when it came out, and I can go and check it out and see what I think of it, you know.
Yeah.
It's fantastic, you know. And you can listen to it on your iPhone or your smartphone. And, you know, we never had any of that stuff 10, 20 years ago, really. It's just a real revolution.
You know what really stands out to me lately is that when I'm listening to stuff on my iPhone, I got so used to the battery running down when I was listening to my old Walkman as a teenager that I think that's how I developed good relative pitch, is because you would hear that, oh, Steve Vai's starting to play about a half step lower. I think I need to replace the batteries.
Yeah, there you go. I always used to like the stories of people like Yngwie Malmsteen, and maybe Vai did it as well, I don't know. These guys that would actually slow down, you know, a record. I don't know if they're talking about a vinyl or tape or whatever. They would slow it down and then work it out, and then speed it back up and play it faster. And I find that quite intriguing that people did that, you know. You can't really do that so much nowadays. I guess you can with software, but people are less likely to bother with it.
Cool. Well, I've got to get going and get ready for this Christmas lunch, so we better leave it there.
All right, mate.
But
yeah
it's been a really fun chat. When does the record come out?
The new album, Gemini Night, it comes out on the 23rd of February on Cleopatra Records.
Cool. And where can people find you on social media?
You can find the MGT official site on Facebook. I think it's listed as my name, like mark.gemini.thwaite. But if you search MGT, it usually comes up. And you'll find us on Twitter. Again, I think it's my name, Mark G. Thwaite, or it might just be Mark Thwaite, and on Instagram as well, which I think that one's Mark G. Thwaite. Yeah, so they're all up there, or it's all linked if you go to the website, which is mgtofficial.com.